Welcome, everybody. This is the second office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, The Economics of Obamacare. And starting out this particular office hours, I am going to do something I don't normally do, which is redo a few minutes from this week's main lecture. So what happened was in lecture two, there was apparently some problem with my video feed or right near the end of the lecture, and people were apparently the audio was coming in bursts for them. And so I'm going to go over this is slide Roman numeral number four, major planks all mesh from that presentation. And so this is just review, but somebody had asked me, can I just go over this slide again? And so that's what I'm going to do now in the beginning of the office hour session. Just so you know, this also, what I'm covering here corresponds to what I did in the assigned reading, The Economics of Obamacare, that I wrote. But I'm just going through this because sometimes it helps to have somebody say the same information verbally. And also, I know some people never read that article, that they just signed up for the course and are going to listen to the lectures, and that's the only amount of time they're going to give us. And so I want to hit these points, because if they haven't read that article, this is pretty crucial stuff. Okay, let me remind you also, I said this in the course, or the main lecture on Wednesday, my plan of attack for this is that, first of all, just so you guys know, there's a lot of people in this class. There's like 160 signed up the last I checked. And I know from getting individual emails from various people, there's different levels of knowledge and interest coming into this. So some people are serious policy wonks that read Paul Krugman every day and Brad DeLong and stuff like that, and they want me to give them really super specific zinger responses. So when they go in the blogs and the comment section and answer and argue with Keynesians, they can point to, oh no, but the CBO said in its latest projection that the cost in fiscal year 2047 is going to be such and such, so you're wrong. Okay, and I am going to try to cater to those people, but then there's other people too that I know that are young free market libertarians who really haven't followed this at all, and they just kind of want a one-stop thing where they say, yeah, I can give 4 weeks to this and listen to four lectures. And so I got to make sure I don't leave them behind. So right now I am giving the big picture, the essential elements of what Obamacare is. And then in the next lecture and in the final week's lecture, I'm going to supplement that with some pretty detailed, wonkish facts about it for those of you who already are pretty well up to speed. Okay, so let me just hit this slide, and then I'll turn to the questions that the people who are logged in live here are posting as I speak. Okay, so what Obamacare's ostensible purpose is, and I say ostensible because I personally and many people think it wasn't that everyone in D.C. who's involved in this was sitting around at night, just couldn't get to sleep because they were so worried about uninsured Americans. And then the whole reason for doing this is, you know what, I would feel better to get insurance. A lot of people think that that's not fully what's going on here. Okay, but at this point, let me just confine myself to the ostensible reasons for this legislation. Okay, so the ostensible reason is, let me say one more thing about that. My view in general, in case you care about how that stuff works, is I don't think the actual politicians, generally speaking, believe in what they're doing. And I've been in Washington enough in terms of some of my clients working there and me going and testifying and dealing with political disputes and so forth. And it's not possible the people at high enough levels in power in Washington naively believe that what they're doing is corresponding to the message being sold to the public. That is impossible. No one could possibly think that. Okay, so it can't be that the senators and their top staffers and things like that are just naive and they don't understand economic theory. And they mean well, but no, that's not possible. All right. What you could argue is that they get there, they go there with good intentions, and then over time they make compromises and say, well, the system is what it is. So if I want to do something, I got to sacrifice these 99 principles and go for this one thing that I think is most important and hope that that gets through. I mean, you might make an argument like that, but there's no way that the people in Washington who vote for higher minimum wage, for example, think they're helping poor people just get paid more. And no one ever told them, no one ever drew a supply and demand diagram for unskilled labor in front of them. That's not what's going on. Okay. But I'm not impugning the millions of people who may have voted for those types of politicians or who publicly support Obamacare and argue on the blogs. Okay, I think a lot of the supporters just haven't thought through the issues very well, are totally ignorant of what we would consider basic economic principles, and they really do just want to support uninsured Americans, and you know, they can't understand why in the world would these Tea Party people want sick people to die in the streets. It mystifies me. You know, I'm a good person. Don't they like Social Security? That give people retirement, though they like Medicare. If it weren't for those government programs, you know, all these old people would be eating cat food and dying. So what the heck, right? I think there are millions of Americans who are that naive. So I get like it was worthwhile me saying that, as I am cynical about Obamacare, the people who constructed it and voted for it in terms of in power, it's impossible that they're just naive about this. That can't be. Whereas I think lots of people who supported it, the rank and file, it's not that they're all really closet fascists. It's entirely possible to me that there's just millions of people who really don't know much about economics. Okay. So, the first bullet point here is called universal coverage. So that is the ostensible rationale for all of this, that hey, the United States is the only advanced economy that doesn't have some version of universal coverage at this point. And that talking point we're going to hit in the last week, remember, about comparisons to other countries. And so that's all we want to do here. We want to make sure that, you know, in this day and age, it shouldn't be the case that an American citizen doesn't have some form of health insurance. Particularly just because they lose the genetic lottery and, you know, have diabetes or cancer or whatever, that's, or a heart problem, they shouldn't just have, their life shouldn't be basically ruined because of that if we're as wealthy as we are. Because actuarially, if everybody is in the system, then it's not going to be that expensive. And other countries allegedly prove that, because they all have universal advanced, you know, Western democracies that are first world, have some version of universal coverage, and it's not like their people are keeling over from having rations imposed upon them, that sort of thing. Okay, so that's the idea. Just like, you know, you're going to have food stamps, because in this day and age, we as a society are not going to tolerate people starving to death in the street. And that's why we have federal food stamps and other poverty relief programs. Okay. So, given that you're going to do that, that's not enough, though. So they want to pass a law that says any insurance company, or any health insurance company, if somebody applies for it, they can't turn the person down. They have to offer a health policy to that applicant. Okay, so now I'm going to start walking through the other planks, though. And of course, all these things are aspects of the actual Affordable Care Act legislation, Affordable Care Act, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act being the official name of the legislation that we all refer to as Obamacare. All these planks are actually in it, but I'm walking you through the logic of why they all have to be in there. Okay. So, given that you're going to do that now, that's not enough. You couldn't just pass a one-page document that said all health insurance companies offering policies in the United States from this date forward must be available for any applicant, you know, who's a U.S. citizen or whatever you want to say. Because if they did that, if that were all that the law required, the insurance companies would easily adapt to it. They would just say, okay, yeah, so somebody comes up to me and applies for health insurance. I'm going to just have a bunch, you know, a type of policy that offers a lifetime cap of $1,000 in a medical bill or medical coverage. And that's the policy I'm going to give them. And so that clearly would be cheating, right? That wouldn't really be effective health coverage if it had a really low cap on how much the insurance company was going to pay out. Because remember, in general, insurance policies do have caps on them, right? That's just one way that they keep premiums down, and they just design a policy to try to cater to what their customers want. Because in principle, if all the policies are open-ended, well, then the insurance company is on the hook. You know, there's more danger in issuing such a policy, so they have to charge higher premiums. Because in principle, that person, for all they know, could just be in the hospital for years and years and so on. Okay, so to avoid that, the law also has to specify minimum standards for the plans, minimum amounts of benefits. It has to say that what sorts of things must be covered. Because otherwise, the plan, not only could they have a really low cap on the total payout, but they could say the only type of medical expense we're going to cover is if, Scott Farkas throws a snowball at your face and you need stitches. But other than that, we don't cover anything with this health insurance policy. Well, that wouldn't really be doing what the intention of the legislation was also. So that's why there had to be a whole host of clauses spelling out these are the minimum things that any new health insurance policy issued must have. So like, coverage for pregnancy, coverage for contraception, okay? So listing all the various things. And then also saying, no caps on payouts, right? That if you happen to run up $2 million in medical bills over the course of several years, well, you have health insurance, and so the insurance company's paying for it, that sort of thing. Okay, so that's where the minimum standards were necessary. But wait a minute. If that's all they did, if they just said, legally, you're a health insurance company, you can't turn away any applicants, and any policies you issue have to satisfy these various criteria in terms of the amount of benefits they offer to the policyholder, that still wouldn't be enough. Because then what would the insurance companies do in response? They would just say, okay, we can live with that, but we're going to just charge the premium accordingly. And so if somebody comes up to us who already has diabetes and applies for a policy, that person's going to pay a lot more for this very nice insurance policy that meets all of your minimum criteria. And we're not going to turn the person away. We're going to say, yeah, sure, we're willing to take you on as a customer. It's just your premium's going to be $5,000 per month. So we're not turning you away. So here you go. Here's where you sign. And we'll take a check right now for $5,000 to get you a Blue Cross Blue Shield card to show that you now have health insurance. Congratulations. We hope you have $60,000 a year to pay for health insurance, but don't worry. You don't have to worry about your medical bills anymore. You see how that would be silly? Right. So that's where the community rating for premiums comes in. And what that means is that they can't individualize, or what some people would use the term discriminate, in terms of the pricing. So they have to put, they have to figure out what the policy is going to be based on minimum standards that the legislation sets in place. And then they have to, they can charge whatever they want, but the point is it has to be the same price to everyone in a given community, where the community is defined by age and geography. Those are the only two demographic characteristics that they can use to make the prices vary. Okay, so if a 50-year-old man comes up and applies for health insurance, and a 22-year-old woman comes up and applies for health insurance, they're allowed to charge a different price because of the age. But if a 50-year-old man and a 50-year-old woman come up, they have to be charged the same price. And in particular, if a 50-year-old man with chronic health problems comes up and applies, and a 50-year-old woman who's in perfect health, they still have to be charged the same premiums. And then they can also make a distinction. If somebody in California applies for health insurance and somebody in Idaho applies, the insurance company is allowed to charge a different price for that reason. Okay, and I need to still go research. I said I was going to do this and find out how fine those geographical distinctions are. Like, if there's one neighborhood that has a lot of gang activity, and then a mile down the street, it's a lot safer. Can they discriminate in price based on that? If somebody who lives in the gang place and a place that's not as heavily subject to shootings and so forth, I don't know if they do it like that, or it's got to be more like by zip code or something. Okay, but that's the basic logic for community rating, because again, otherwise it would be a farce. They would just charge ridiculous premiums to people that they actually didn't want to give coverage to. Okay, and incidentally, and that really, think of the logic, that's true right now. Okay, it's not so much in terms of the economics that there are people that a health insurance company would absolutely refuse to cover. Like, even people who all have really high risk of heart attacks or something like that. In principle, in terms of the actuarial logic of it, a company would be willing to give them health insurance. It's just the premiums would be so high, nobody would pay it. They would just say, you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to just go ahead and be uninsured, because that's ridiculous for me to pay that much. I can't afford to pay that much, or just, well, holy cow, I'm going to end up paying that much in premiums. That's not much better than if I just paid out of pocket. I mean, in the limit, if you knew with certainty that you were going to have $60,000 in medical expenses this year, and the insurance company knew that also, well, if they were going to offer you a policy for it to make sense for them, they would have to charge you at least $60,000 in premiums, right? So the whole point of insurance is you want to be part of a pool where only some of you are going to actually have to bear the expense, at least in a certain time period, and then you all kind of spread the burden evenly by paying premiums that are lower than what would happen, than what you'd have to pay if the thing hits. Okay, then as far as the employer mandate, that was, the legislation only applies to employers with 50 or more full-time employees, where full-time is defined as 30 plus hours per week. So why did they do that? Because they wanted, they didn't want to screw with the current system, because most Americans right now get their health insurance from their employer, and they're generally happy with that. I mean, they might wish it were cheaper, that kind of thing. But if Obamacare had meant that every American would have to lose his health insurance coverage and then sign up for something new, it would not have passed. That would have scared people. So the way they sold it was to say, hey, we're just doing a little tweak here to cover the millions of Americans who are uninsured. But right now, as Obama famously said, if you like your plan, you can keep it. Okay, so that's why they were hitting it from the employer side, is they didn't want to just take everything and just put the onus completely on the individual. They were trying to work within the existing system and just tweak it a little bit. All right. But the reason they didn't just say all employers have to face this mandate, the reason they limited it to larger employers and only their full-time employees is that, ostensibly the reason is they recognized you can't just take some little mom-and-pop shop with three employees and lay this huge burden on them that might be many thousands of dollars. That would just be clearly a huge burden on small businesses. And for whatever reason, politically, small businesses are actually surprisingly powerful. Just like farmers, you know, that's like a big thing. Like small businesses have lobbyists and stuff like that. Okay. So they, and selling it to the public. An onerous new business regulation imposed on small businesses sounds bad, whereas making some big company pay for something sounds great. That's just the way the political reality works. Okay. Last component, then I'll turn to your guys' questions who are logged in here. It's if they had just done all that, it might still have blown up in their faces, because so far in the four bullet points I've covered, all of the onus, all of the burden, all of the sticks in terms of how is the potential power and might the federal government going to be used to force some entity to do something it wouldn't otherwise have wanted to do, has been directed at businesses, at the health insurance companies in particular, but also employers. Oh, let me say one more thing about the employer mandate. Another reason, though, for putting that mandate in place, because you might be like, well, wait a minute, but if most people already have their health insurance from their employer, that's not changing anything to just say there's a mandate. I don't get it. Because when Obamacare gets implemented, what if all of a sudden all those plans that were traditionally being offered by employers, what if the insurance companies rerun the numbers and now that they have to basically accept millions of people, many of whom had pre-existing conditions, so they know they're paying a lot more in claims, healthcare claims. The insurance companies they have to raise premiums across the board, otherwise they're going to go out of business. So now from the employers who the day before Obamacare passed were offering coverage to their employees with, you know, a certain kind of plan, what if now all of a sudden they get the notice from their health insurance provider that says, oh, by the way, for your plan, your group plans now, it's going to be three times as much or four times as much. And well, next week we'll get into some of the estimates of just how much sticker shock there's going to be and how much the insurance companies are going to raise premiums because of this legislation. But in some markets, yeah, it's like a tripling or a quadrupling of premiums for certain types of plans. Okay, so the point is, even a big company that offers as part of its standard compensation package, yep, here's your salary, you get 2 weeks off, you get paid holidays, you get this, you get, you know, blah, 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 maternity leave, and oh, by the way, you know, you also had a pretty decent health insurance plan. You know, our employees like this, they're pretty happy with it. Well, if all of a sudden the cost of delivering that to their employees triples, the employer might say, you know what, we're going to drop this. We're just going to raise your guys' wages and you will get insurance yourself. Okay, so they didn't want that to happen. Then people would have been outraged because a lot of employers would do that. And so that was the function of having the mandate. And actually, we'll talk about this more next week. That's still happening. But the point is, if they didn't have any kind of mandate on the employer at all, it would have happened in droves. And so it could have been that most Americans would have new insurance policies because of this legislation, and there would have been outrage. Whereas right now what's happening is just people like me. Self-employed people are people who are buying insurance in the individual market, not from their employers. They were the ones who are having their coverage dropped or changed. All right. Okay, Georgia, so you're saying the audio is starting to fail? Okay, let's just see what happens if we slog through this. Okay, because unfortunately there's nothing I can do on my end. There's one trick I can try. Just let me know how it goes. Okay, last thing, and then I'll turn to your guys' questions. Sorry, this is taking so long. If they had just done all that stuff that I said so far, putting the onus on businesses, the whole thing could still blow up in their face, because what if individuals now, the ones who are uninsured, a lot of them are uninsured by choice. I mean, they're all uninsured by choice in a certain sense, but they're uninsured because they're healthy and young. And they're saying, you know what, it's just, I'm going to take the chance. I don't want to pay so much for this policy. And so that could still happen, especially because the price for a policy is going to go up now after Obamacare. In other words, if they were choosing not to get covered before, if we're talking about healthy people now, if they were just saying, you know what, it's just, I don't think I'm going to need it. If they weren't getting covered before, now when Obamacare gets passed and policies can double or triple in price, well, now they're really not going to sign up, okay? And so that probably would have spelled the doom of private health insurance in this country, because actuarially that wouldn't have made sense. You know, if all of a sudden you just say, okay, now the insurance companies, you have to accept a bunch of people who are sick already, and that's it. There you go. I mean, that would just really wreck, because then if they adjusted and had to charge the premium, the higher the premiums are, more people would not sign up, and then it would just turn into a bad equilibrium where only sick people would go and sign up for the coverage, and so the insurance companies, to break even, would have to raise the premiums such that the sick people wouldn't be able to afford it, and so the whole system would just break down. So the way they're allegedly going to deal with that is with this individual mandate and say everybody has to get it. So it's not just everyone has the option of health insurance. In order for the thing to work and to keep private insurance, health insurance viable, they had to use coercion on everybody to get everybody into the system, in the hopes that with everybody paying in, we can afford to cover everyone. So that's the logic. So that's why this all fits together, and you couldn't just have had portions of it. Okay. Hey, George, how's the audio right now? Did it come back, or has it been bad since you typed that in? Okay. So yeah, thanks for letting me know. Let me know how it goes. Okay. Let's turn now to, so that took longer than I had intended, but I hope that helps you guys, that I walk through that a little bit more carefully so you can see why this all fits together. And what's great about it, but the reason I like it, is it just shows Mises's general principle of interventionism, that the government can't just do a one little piecemeal intervention to fix the particular problem that they don't like, or that the public doesn't like, about the market outcome, that will lead to unintended consequences that are worse from everyone's perspective. And so then the government has to keep enlarging the scope of its interventions. until ultimately you reach full-blown socialism. And so that's, you see that logic here where I already walked you through several things that had to happen for this to even have a chance of working, and it's still not going to work, by the way. I mean, that's what I think a lot of the people who push this through knew full well it's not going to work, but they think this is the path to single payer and then ultimately nationalized healthcare. So don't think that, oh, because we hit these five bullet points, now it's all going to work. That's not the case at all. Okay, but let me turn to your guys' questions. Okay, so Mark Pretty asks, how do we answer the charge that we're being heartless when we say that people will be demanding too much medical care? Won't our opponents respond that we want people to demand medical care when they need it? I mean, it's not like they're asking for something frivolous like caviar or something. People seek medical help when they're hurt or sick. Right. That's a good question, Mark. And I would not I think if you're arguing with someone about this, your stance should not be, hey, the system was working pretty well for most people the week before this stuff passed, so let's just go back to that. You know, and I mean, I don't know, it's not fair to tax rich people a little bit more on their Medicare payments or Medicare taxes in order for millions of people to get covered. That's not the way I'd frame it. I would say this legislation is not doing what you think it's going to do. Okay, so for one thing, and we're going to cover this next week, I was going to do it in this previous week's lecture, but we ran out of time. And I'm still trying to find a little harder numbers on this, but there are people who are claiming they are losing their coverage, the sick people, the people with cancer, who are saying that what happened is they had a policy, like a catastrophic policy, that they were using, and that was, you know, some guy, I'm making this story up a little bit, but there are people in real life claiming this is what happened to them. All right. And the reason I want to research it more carefully is you see this stuff like being trumpeted on Fox, like Sean Hannity's show, and people who hate Obama with a passion, and that's their whole shtick to their fans is how much they hate Obama. And so, you know, those guys are not known for being paragons of intellectual honesty. And so I want to independently make sure that this phenomenon is real and it's not just Fox News making something up. But the claim is, which at least theoretically is plausible, is that, look, you could have somebody – let me just make sure you guys get this point. So my current insurance plan, the one that I had before Obamacare passed, is now illegal. I have some kind of extension or something, like I can keep it until the summer. But the point is, I am one of the millions of Americans to whom Obama just lied through his teeth. And yes, he was lying. It's not possible that he didn't understand. We're going to go over this next week. The officials with the Obama administration were arguing amongst each other about, hey, should we keep letting the boss lie to the people on national television when we all know full well that millions of people are going to lose their coverage? Isn't that going to come back to bite us down the road when they realize that? And he said he's been lying for years about it. I mean, they had debates like that. So this isn't like, oh, shoot, we had no idea. No, they're consciously lying through their teeth. But anyway, the reason I'm losing my coverage is that I had a catastrophic plan. I'm fairly healthy. I barely ever go to the doctor, let alone the hospital. And so I opted to have a really high deductible that just covered me, you know, in case I get a car accident or something. Or, yeah, if I do get a brain tumor out of the blue, then I wanted to have health insurance for that reason. And so I did that to keep my premium manageable. And I just paid for them, and I had a really high deductible. Well, that plan is illegal. Okay, so here's what's happening. So I'm losing my – there are people allegedly right now – who had such a plan before, and then they needed it. They did come down with cancer. And so they're getting treatment, you know, they're getting chemotherapy or whatever, and their coverage is, their insurance company's paying for most of it. Because they, fortunately for them, did have health insurance. They had a catastrophic plan, and now they're getting it. But the plan they have is illegal under Obamacare. And so they're going to get dropped. And then just the way the numbers work, if they try to, yeah, they're still now eligible to sign up for health insurance under Obamacare, because even though they have cancer, the companies can't turn them away. But they went to apply for it, and seeing how much they would now have to be, so the premium they'd have to pay under Obamacare is way higher than the premium they had to pay originally, because they originally had a catastrophic plan. And that, at least I've seen a few people testify, not in court testify, but like on, you know, to a reporter or something, claim that they just can't afford the new policies under Obamacare, and that they're just going to die. They can no longer get treatment. Okay, so there's things like that. And then just in general, the government is clearly going to engage in rationing. All right, so I guess what I'm saying is, it is not the case that what Obamacare is going to give us is that we're going to give a bunch of medical care to people who didn't get it before, and we're going to make a few rich fat cats pay for it. That's what the average Obamacare supporter thinks is going on. They think it's just a bunch of free stuff given to people who need it, paid for by, you know, rich millionaires who, oh, maybe they're going to have to get one fewer limousine in their lifetime so that these 30 homeless kids or 30 poor kids can get tuberculosis shots or something, right? Like, that's kind of the way they're thinking. As I'm saying, you know, try to get them to see that that's not true, that it's not necessarily the case they're going to get better care. But then ultimately, okay, and then Mark comes back and clarifies. I guess I was approaching it from what many free market types say, that the reason we have such high costs for medical care is because consumers are demanding too much of it. If people were more selective, they would choose cheaper options or just not go to the doctor. Okay, yeah. So, let me hone in on that part. You're right. So just to make sure everyone understands Mark's excellent question, there's a danger where if what we do is the free market economist explaining what's wrong with the current system, and I did this too, and it's correct, but Mark is right that rhetorically it can come off a little bit heartless or something like that, is if we point out and say, oh, you know why medical bills are so high, you know why hospitals can get away with charging so much, is that there's a third-party payment system, that people don't engage in careful cost comparisons. If your physician says, you know what, you need to, you know, something's screwy with your heart, I'm going to go send you to a cardiologist, and then, you know, writes you up a recommendation, like, so yeah, here's, I know this guy, he's down at St. Jude's Hospital, blah, 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 here you go. Most people just think, well, I got to go to this specialist because my physician told me to, and this is the guy, and oh my gosh, what's wrong with my heart? And you don't think about it in terms of price, because if you have insurance, you know, kind of in the back of your mind, you know, well, my insurance company's going to pay most of this. And all you're looking for when you get that final bill is, you know, what's my contribution? And it's typically going to be a fraction of what the actual official number was for how much that service cost. Okay. So Mark is saying, when you couch the argument like that, and then say, oh man, now that everyone's going to be covered with Obamacare, everyone's going to think it's free, and everyone's going to be just going to the hospital when they get a splinter, this is what we did, that it makes it look like we're just saying the solution is to just have people not get health coverage and just suck it up and deal with it themselves and not go to doctors so much. And so there's two things going on, Mark. So that is true, but there's two sides of the story. I mean, it's supply and demand. And the reason the price is so, I'm hoping I'm doing this right from your guys' perspective. So the way you guys have seen it, this should be the supply curve and this should be the demand curve, if I'm not getting mixed up in my head here, right? And so what happens is, yeah, when the government, well, when there's third-party system, the demand for healthcare goes up because people aren't actually paying as much out of pocket for it. But also, government intervention restricts the supply. And so that's why the price ends up being so much higher. And so, like, for example, I just blogged about this, that story that was going around Thanksgiving about two people who went to the emergency room to get stitches, and the bill was something like $2,200 to get three stitches. because she like fell off a rock or something and just, you know, split her knee a little bit of the skin and had to go and went to the ER, just got 3 stitches, and the bill was like $2,200. Okay, so yeah, part of that was the reason the hospital charges so much is that so many people are just going to the ER reflexively thinking their insurance is going to cover it or thinking, I'm just not going to pay this. And, you know, they can mail me bills, but I'm not going to pay it. What are they going to do? They're not going to throw me in jail. And so hospitals, because of that, have to charge the paying people more because they're giving a lot of care for free. That's another element, by the way. Okay. But the other element is it's really, you know, you can't just go down the street and open up a shop and say, hey, I'll perform, I'll give you stitches and I'll check your heart and check your blood pressure and I'll do all kinds of stuff and do mildly invasive operations if you're not licensed. That would be illegal. The government would come and shut you down. Okay, so they're completely restricting the supply of medical professional services while they're also augmenting the demand. And so that's why the price is so high. So Mark, certainly one thing to mention is to say that the government right now is putting up huge roadblocks in the ability of people to enter the medical profession. And so that's partly what drives up prices. But the other thing too is that having the government take care of it is not going to magically increase the amount of resources. Okay, so it's the virtue of letting markets decide and having market prices. I'm fumbling here to try to figure out the best. Obviously, with your argument with people, you've got to figure out what sounds best given the person with whom you're discussing this. But let me put it to you this way. It's to introduce competition into – okay, let me try it like this. You got 100 people, and right now, and you say to them, just go to any doctor you want to get any kind of coverage you want, and we'll pay for it. Or you say to them, we're going to give you each, and let's say that if you did that in practice, on average, the people consume $2,000 worth of medical care per year. I'm just making that number up. Instead of that, now, you, the institution that was just giving them on average $2,000 a year, what you say to those same people is, at the beginning of the year, we're just going to give you $1,800. And then you do what you want with it, but we're not covering your medical bill. On average, they would all be better off. Because now, or if you did it with enough people, because now they would be much more careful about what they spent the money on, and they wouldn't just run frivolous medical bills. And so because of that, the providers of medical services would lower the prices they were charging, or they would have to look around harder for cost-saving innovations. And so it would end up that the price would be different. So, I mean, would you say in the computer market, right now it's not like there's the people have their, when they buy a new laptop, that they have some kind of insurance company paying for that. And yet it doesn't seem like there's this, oh man, Americans just can't get their hands on computing power because they have to pay for it out of pocket and we let market prices ration. And it's not that if insurance companies suddenly got in between consumers and laptop manufacturers that all of a sudden now Americans just have a lot better laptops and lower out-of-pocket expenditures. No, what would end up happening is you would probably pay more when all is said and done, and you would get inferior products. If you went to Best Buy and picked out the laptop model, and then at the register you ended up paying 10% of the price, and then your insurance company paid the other 90%, after a while, that would make you worse off. You would be paying more for inferior laptops. Okay, and so it's the same thing with medical care. Just having the government get involved doesn't magically increase the amount of doctors and hospitals. it just changes the incentives of how that stuff gets distributed. Okay. And then Mark comes back and says, if you have consumers demanding more services, wouldn't the supply of doctors increase to accommodate it just from a simple supply and demand perspective? Well, in general, yeah. If all of a sudden the demand for a product goes up, then the market price goes up. And then at the higher market price, you move along the supply curve and the quantity supplied goes up. And that partially brings the price back down. Okay, so that's true in general, but it's hard for me to know exactly what you mean. So it's or what experiment you're conducting in your head for what the applicability of that. It's there's also, okay, I think I see, if you're saying, what if they did that and now consumers are watching, cut, you know, looking at their pennies more carefully, wouldn't that lower the price of medical services and wouldn't fewer people go into it? Possibly, if that's the only thing you tweaked, but if you also simultaneously got rid of all of the medical licensing regulations, then that would more than offset it. So that's the way I would put it. So, the big answer to your question is, Mark's saying, you said there was nothing in the law to make more doctors. Right, but also what's in the law, why the proponents, and we're going to talk about this next week, the proponents of Obamacare are saying it's going to reduce average healthcare costs is because now the government's going to be more involved and they're going to limit the payments. Okay, so doctors and people like that are going to get less for performing certain medical procedures because of this legislation. That's unambiguously clear. And they're going to have to deal with more bureaucracy. So that's part of what may be the ticking demographic time bomb in this, is that at the same time the legislation is clearly letting millions of people come in and get more medical care than they did in the status quo, they're limiting the payments that doctors can get from certain procedures and in hospitals get whatever. And so a lot of them are either saying I'm not taking people who are part of Obamacare, or they're just not going into medicine altogether. Okay, so we're gonna go over this more next week. So You're right. Certain of these arguments taken in isolation, you might say, but wait a minute, just focusing on that one little effect, you know, wouldn't it just do such and such? But when you realize all the different things this legislation is going to be doing simultaneously, it's really going to be a triple, quadruple whammy. Okay. George asks, trying to get a clear distinction. And so, by the way, George is asking something that's not directly related to this particular class, which is totally fine. George says, trying to get a clear distinction between economics and political economy. I think of economics as the absence of government. Since government is always present, all we really deal with is political economy, right? Rothbard isolated the two in man, economy, and state, but his real world analysis usually dealt with the presence of government. That's a good question, George. I know how to define economics, but as you in the context of your question, I'm not sure how you define political economy. I'm trying to think, because when I was a student at Hillsdale College, which was very rich in the Austrian tradition, of course, there was a class on political economy, and then there were just the standard econ classes. And I'm trying to remember, well, as I'm sitting here walking through it mentally, let me just say it out loud. This might help you, George. So the way they broke it up at Hillsdale was, yeah, the economics courses per se, you know, micro, macro, intermediate, micro, intermediate, macro, that kind of stuff. Austrian one, Austrian two, history of economic thought, you know, that sort of sequence for someone who's majoring in economics. Yeah, I mean, it would start with the technical analysis of completely laissez-faire economy, assuming no government intervention, but that was just for simplicity. I mean, later on, I mean, even an introductory micro, before that semester's over, and I'm speaking now for when I was there also teaching, because I was an undergrad student at Hillsdale, and then I went back, and that's where I taught for 3 years. I mean, you would get into taxation, you know, to do standard stuff like if there's a sales tax levied on the consumer, what happens to the market? And that, you know, the demand shifts left, and then that makes the price go up, and so depending on the elasticity of the supply and demand for that good, the producer ends up bearing some of the burden because of, you know, the demand for the product decreased, and that sort of thing. The price goes down because the demand curve shifts left. And so the producer eats some of it because he gets a lower price. The consumer doesn't pay the full burden because the pre-tax price is lower, even though the post-tax price is higher than what the original laissez-faire price was. Okay, so that kind of analysis of taxation is standard microeconomics that's in any, you know, so you wouldn't call that political economy. That's, you know, in there. Or the Austrian theory of the business cycle, I clearly covered that in the Austrian economics courses at Hillsdale that were for upper-level econ majors. And so I wouldn't have called that political economy. I would have called that Austrian economics. A staple of Austrian economic analysis is the study of the business cycle. Whereas political economy was, that was a course that was more, not so much focused just on the technical economics of it, but more of like the interaction of political philosophy with some knowledge of economics, but not super technical economics. Okay, so there, like the guy who taught that would have everyone read that the main textbook was Bastiat's The Law. And so, yeah, you know, Bastiat was a wonderful economist, and in The Law, it would touch on economic issues, but it was also, you know, the stuff about legalized plunder and things like that, and that the state is the great fiction by which people can have everyone else pay for everything or something like that. You know, I don't know if all those quotes came from The Law, but those are all Bastiat quotes, right? So it was, I don't know if that's helping you, but I think that's the, and I can't give you a crisp definition, but I think that's the way most people think about it, that economics is a technical subject of studying objectively what happens to the economy. One of the main things you would study is the impact of various types of government interventions. Whereas political economy, it's sort of like you would want to know what James Madison thought. You would want to know, you know, you would read more about libertarianism. You'd want to know stuff like power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so, you know, you'd have those elements. You'd want to know things like with antitrust. Okay, maybe this is a way to think about it, George. Think about antitrust legislation. I think it's economics would just look at it and say, if the government approaches some large company and breaks it up, claiming right now it's in violation of, or it's reducing competition, and so it's in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act, and then we want to know what's going to be the implication. How is that going to affect prices? How is that going to affect innovation? the quality of products that consumers are getting 5 years from now, blah, 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 blah. Those would be narrow technical economic questions. But then if you wanted to say something like, you know, historically, most lawsuits brought under the Sherman Antitrust Act were not brought by disinterested academics or consumer groups, but were brought by competitors of the dominant firm in an industry. And so it was really just a tool by which certain companies could attack their superiors whom they couldn't outcompete in the free marketplace. That's more of a political economy kind of analysis. Okay, so you might still get it. You know, in an economics course talking about antitrust, the professor might take a few moments to mention that stuff, and vice versa. In a political economy course, if you're talking about antitrust and how historically, you know, the legislation was lobbied for by these groups and the government broke up this company because they didn't give enough campaign contributions in the last election cycle and they were punishing them and blah, blah. I mean, to be complete, you would need to do at least a dabble of the actual economics involved. But the focus would not just be on the narrow technical economics. It would also be more understanding how politics works. So the two overlap, and you're right. In a certain sense, in the modern time, anybody talking about economics is doing political economy, but I'm just letting you know that term has more of a connotation that it's not so heavy on the rigorous technical economics, but it is also more involving political philosophy. Okay, I think okay, and so then one last question here, and then we're out of time. Vitor asks, Bob, is there a go-to book for fallacies on healthcare, just as economics in one lesson, that you know of? Hang on, let me look. I want to make sure I say the right. I haven't read this book, but the best guy that I know of is this guy John Goodman, not the actor. In his famous book is that's put out by the Independent Institute is called Priceless. And then the subtitle is Curing the Healthcare Crisis. Okay, so like I said, I have not actually read this book, but I've seen Goodman's analysis in several places, and it's excellent. And the fact that this is put out by the Independent Institute makes me trust that it's got to be good stuff. Okay, so if I had to recommend a single book, it would be John Goodman, Priceless. And that's a clever title. The reason he's calling it Priceless is because on the one hand, it makes it sound like it's great, you know, like those commercials. $100 for the corsage, $200 to rent the limo, $200 to rent the tuxedo, a night spent at the prom, priceless, you know, that kind of stuff. So he's making a pun off of that because he's saying the reason our healthcare system is so screwed up is that the government's not allowing market prices to do their job. And so that's why he's saying it's priceless. That's why it's all messed up. Okay, so that if I had to right now pick a book, it would be that one, but with the understanding I technically had not read that book. Okay, why don't we stop there, guys? Before I let you guys go, can you just give me some feedback? Oh, and I see George is saying, Bob, your book on human action, is it available yet? No, I delivered the initial manuscript to them a while ago, but it's big, you know, it's 350 pages, something like that. So that it's out being perused by various people. And so I don't know what they're, I think probably they have to wait to hear back from those outside reviewers before saying, okay, here, we're setting a tentative release date. Let's get this thing ready to make sure we can hit that day. We're not even at that stage yet, George. But let me just say, I think it's pretty cool. Naturally, I'm not an unbiased source on that, but it was not me. It was not a study guide. We did that on purpose because I've already written a study guide to Human Act, and other people have written guides for Mises. It's not just me summarizing what he's doing in each section. I'm trying to illustrate his point in various parts of the book in different words and using like numerical examples and things that an intelligent layperson can easily grasp. And so, I mean, I think I learned a bunch about what Mises was doing in Human Action from writing the book. And so I think a lot of people who read this new book, even if you've already read Human Action cover to cover, are going to walk away saying, okay, yeah, now I understand more what Mises was doing in that amazing work. And by the way, that's a good thing too. It's not like I went through it and was like, oh man, Mises is not as smart as I remembered. No, it's the other way around. I was just constantly blown away by, holy cow, this guy is a genius. So that was kind of neat too. Okay, last thing before I let you guys go. What was the sound? I know, George, you said the audio started to fail a little bit, but overall, you guys have been listening to me for an hour. What happened? Was there just a few moments where it was a little bit off? Okay, all right, good. So I think this is what we'll do going forward. Okay, all right, thanks, guys. See you on, Wednesday?